So there is a moment, there are moments as you're growing up where you're like having to think through what do you think you want to be doing? But it's just, I mean, you know, I want to be a fireman. I want to go to the moon. I want to, you know, all kinds of things come out in that kind of dreaming state. But when it comes down to brass tacks, like, are you going to actually do this? Are you going to invest in your time and your energy in doing this thing? That's a whole other matter, because you don't see the path between here and there. And so not seeing the path means you don't know if it's worth it to you to spend that capital that you have on that effort.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't checked it out yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, books, TED Talks, and much more. And when our first book comes out in August, that's where we'll be announcing all of the pre-order bonuses. So visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter to sign up and to learn more. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. The other day, I was reading an article on Medium about the 8 major keys to getting hired in the 21st century, and one of those was to make a website. This is exactly what the author said. It's mandatory nowadays. Just about every job application has a field for links or website. So make one. It should say who you are, what you like to do, and what you're all about. And our friends at HostGator can help you get started. With 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, you're in good hands. And they have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and if you really want to get your hands dirty, one-click WordPress installs. Having a web presence of some sort isn't an option for your career. It's a necessity. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative to get 30% off all hosting packages. Jessica, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited for this.
Yeah. Well, it is my pleasure to have you here. You know, I came across your story by way of our mutual friend, Terry Gentile, who was a former guest here. And when she introduced us, I went and did some digging and I was like, oh my God, I'm like, you absolutely have to be a guest on our show. Your work is so fascinating to me. So rather than give it away for our listeners, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, how that has led you to all these amazing things that you're doing and this perspective that you have on storytelling?
Yeah, so I'm a cartoonist primarily, or I've always been a cartoonist primarily. I also do a lot of other things, but I've been making comics since I was in college, and that's now a long time ago. So I have a lot of comics under my belt, and that encompasses a lot of things for me. I started off doing kind of very small, quotidian, sort of realistically drawn short stories, and then soon kind of moved into doing some nonfiction, doing some reported stories, but, you know, short ones for the local newspaper called The New City in Chicago, and then back to fiction. I did a graphic novel, and then started teaching comics, and with my husband, who's also a cartoonist, Matt Madden, we wrote two really giant textbooks about making comics, and wrote another graphic novel and working on another one. And there's this other thread that is really relevant here, which is that I've done now two books about radio and, you know, its sibling, podcasting, from the perspective of the narrative storytelling podcasts, meaning things in the model of This American Life and its inheritors. So I did a book in 1999 with Ira Glass called Radio, an Illustrated Guide. It's a very short little magazine-style comic book about how This American Life made their show. It literally step by step. How do they go through? How do they get an idea? How do they vet those ideas? How do they report the stories, write them? Do the interviews, edit, do sound, and go on the air. I mean, everything in 30 pages. And that book was co-written with Ira, but I also found it really interesting and inspiring, work to do myself, because it was the first time I'd encountered a really strategic approach to telling stories. So this is 1999. I'd been making comics for about 10 years at that point. And constructing stories had always been just this enormous struggle for me. It had just been so difficult. I would have ideas for sort of an interesting character or a situation or something, and I just would have no idea how to move forward from there. And for whatever reason, it just never occurred to me to go to the library and check out books on, I don't know, screenwriting or something. Like, there are books about this. You know, Aristotle wrote about this. But I just never read those books, and never sort of, even though I was an English major in school, like, never encountered any sort of structural work on how to make stories. And I had started kind of stabbing at it, not blindly, but almost, before I worked on this book with Ira. But once I worked with him, and he has this very specific way of thinking about how stories should be put together and what works. And certainly then, you know, now I think he's opened out in so many different ways. I mean, the show is so different than it was in 99. But I found the structure really interesting. And I don't think I realized it at the time, but it totally set me on a path at that point of investigating more and learning more about how does one build stories? How does one go about building stories in a strategic and thoughtful way? You know, how can you, when you're stuck, like, what kind of tools do you have that you can apply to the problem, you know? Mm-hmm. And that kind of strategic thinking was something that just was renewed to me. So fast forward, I don't know, it was about 11, 12 years later, I went back to Ira to say, hey, you know, I'd really like to do an update on this book. It's a more complicated story than that, but kind of boring. And he said, oh, sure, you know, another 10 pages. And I was like, no, I'm thinking like a book, like a book. He's kind of like, yeah, no, that was really hard the first time around, and I'm busy, so I'm not going to do that. And so we talked about it some more, because he thought, you know, it's not like it was a terrible idea, but he just couldn't see kind of getting involved at the level that he had been before. And we talked about it, and the idea came out, and I'm not sure if it was him or me or both, really, to really take a look at what was happening in radio at the time. So we're talking 2011, early 2012. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, by then there's just this whole cadre of new shows that did essentially what we talked about in the end of Radio and Illustrated Guide, which is to take these basic tools, this basic structural approach, and run it through somebody else's creative mind, somebody else's view of the world, and come up with something completely different. And so we went to, I went to, I think, initially 4 other shows, and then it sort of expanded out a little bit from that to about 7 different shows or, you know, producers. Went to talk to them about, not specifically how do they make their show, because we'd already covered that in great detail in Radio and Illustrated Guide. Mm-hmm. And the process, the literal process, has not changed almost at all. You know, yes, the technology is updated, but the basic structure is the same. But what had changed, or what, I mean, had changed, it hasn't changed, this hasn't changed either, but what I didn't look into in the first place and came back to was this, the underlying conceptual structure of the storytelling. What do they think about when they're making stories? How did these great producers, and I ended up talking to, I have 35 different producers, how do they go about making their work? How do they go about choosing the stories? How do they think about pulling the threads together? What's important? What makes it good? What makes it different? You know, why is The Moth as good as it is? You know, what do those directors do to pull those stories out of the people who perform? How do they develop those stories? Why can 99% Invisible do, you know, an entire episode on concrete benches and we're gripped? Like, what's their secret? And so that became a book that I brought out last August called Out on the Wire, The Storytelling Secrets of the New Masters of Radio, and where I sort of broke it down into structural categories and compare and contrast all these producers' approaches to their work. I feel like it's sort of the culmination of this, that sounds like I'm done. I'm not done, but culmination of many years of thinking about how stories work.
Wow. Well, that raises lots of questions, as you might imagine. One of the things I like to ask everybody is about their childhood and looking back at formative experiences growing up, mentors, parents, influences that ultimately led them down the path that they ended up choosing. Because it seems like you figured out fairly early in your life that you were destined to do this thing.
I think that's strongly worded.
Fair enough.
My childhood. Well, I do know that I've always been major obsessive about stories, reading stories initially, not making them. You know, I didn't make comics as a small child. I didn't write a lot of fiction. I didn't write poetry. You know, none of that stuff that a lot of people who become writers later did as teenagers. I did draw. And I did do sort of some proto, you know, comics-like things, but it sort of just didn't occur to me to try to make comics or to write stories. I don't know why not. But I did read voraciously and just had a tendency when I was younger to just lose myself in stories to the point where, like, you know, I'd just walk around in a daze, you know, and in the shower I'd be thinking about what was going to happen. And when I finished the book, it would take, you know, days and days for it to like leave me, you know, as I'd just be obsessing about what would happen to these characters after the story ended and so on. So that's probably a sign, I guess. In terms of deciding to make comics, I feel like that's a complicated question because I don't know that I'm actually destined to make comics because I find the process of breaking down story into images and going through all the labor of putting, you know, actually making the pages, making the images, not particularly joyful often, you know, like I'm good at it. I know how to do it. And it's a skill that I have I've won through very hard labor. And, I'm glad I have it. But it's some cartoonists just like some cartoonists sit around sketching in their sketchbooks all the time. Mm-hmm. Just drawing just flows out of them. It's just the way they live. Yeah. But for me, my creativity is like much more dispersed than that. I like to garden, you know, I like to build furniture. I like to, you know, just write things. I like to talk to people. I like to, you know, teach. I like to speak. I can feel like when I was working out on the wire, I was on a very tight deadline. I felt very, very constrained by the process of having to, you know, once I had gone through, you know, a year of research and a year of writing, to spend another year taking what I'd already basically processed, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of the writing and make that into drawings was just like, oh man, really? Which any cartoonist can identify with. There's always a point at which you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I had another 100 pages to draw.
Yeah.
But, you know, all that said, it's a complicated question. You know, it's not, I don't feel like I'm either destined or not destined for it. It's like, it's what I chose to do. And I threw myself into it early enough that, it's, you know, let me just put it this way. When I watched the first season of True Detective, the one line that stuck with me from this whole thing was near the end, one of the last couple episodes, where Rust says, be careful what you get good at. Mm. You know, we really only have time to get really good at one thing in our lives, so be careful what you get good at. And I think about that sometimes when I'm in the middle of a giant comics project.
Interesting. Do you think everybody has this one thing that they're able to get good at or capable of getting good at, like exceptional at in their lives?
No, actually, that's what I'm saying is I feel like I could have gotten good at a lot of other things. Right. And I am pretty good at a lot of other things. Maybe not at the same level. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not known at the same level for a lot of other things. But, you know, I realized at some point when I was in my early 20s, like, I am really good at organization. Like, I would have made an excellent movie producer, you know, or like a contractor, mm-hmm. you know, somebody who has to do, you know, has to strategically think about many different people's roles in a job. So like, that's a skill that is like completely not used when I'm making a comic book.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, what I'm doing right now in terms of, you know, sort of my new direction, new stuff I'm working on, new book I'm working on is this thing about creative productivity. Like, it's completely useful there, where I'm helping other people figure out how to get their mm-hmm. creative work happening. So it's not that I'm never going to use it. And maybe that quote is a little too dire, because, you know, I feel like I'm able to get good at a few things, maybe not only one.
Yeah. When you look back over your body of work, is there a thread or a theme that you think runs throughout the work? And how do people find that in theirs and in their work?
Well, you know, interestingly, there are a couple different points at which I've realized that I have themes, and they're very different themes that, you know, like the whole thing of investigating how stories work is a huge theme in my work that goes through like all my nonfiction. So it goes from Radio and Illustrated Guide in 99, and then through teaching and developing materials to teach comics, because I taught for, I guess, 12 years at the School of Visual Arts in New York, and I keep teaching. You know, I'm teaching online at the school, California College of Arts right now in their master's program. So that teaching process is like a theme, and teaching how to break down constructing stories and figuring out how to convey that to students is a big thing. So then when we made our textbooks, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures and Mastering Comics, you know, that was an expression of that. And then, of course, Out on the Wire. So that's one big thing. But, you know, a completely different, unrelated theme was something I discovered really only through doing interviews, I think, or being interviewed, rather, when I was doing interviews about... probably about La Perdida, my graphic novel, or maybe about Life Sucks, the one that I did the script for. Anyway, there are two books there. So La Perdida is a book about a woman named Carla Olivares, who moves to Mexico City kind of on a whim. And she has an estranged Mexican father, but she doesn't speak Spanish and doesn't know anything about Mexico. And she has these kind of really blinkered views about what it means to be Mexican and what she's going to find there and what kind of experience she's going to have, which causes incredible distortions in how she perceives people around her and how she thinks that they should approach, you know, how they should relate to her. And she misses this whole part of the story, which is the power dynamic between Americans and Mexicans that just exists and that you have to acknowledge and deal with to deal honestly. Especially when you're an American abroad in Mexico. And, you know, you're not talking about somebody of Mexican origin who's American, but you're talking about, like, you know, I speak English, I have a passport, you know, whatever, like those kinds of issues. She's just like, I don't want to deal with any of that stuff. And then when I did this book, Life Sucks, which I co-wrote with Gabe Soria, and it was drawn by another person, Warren Pleece, that's a book about young vampires in love. It's a romantic comedy about vampires set in L.A., but the whole premise of it is that this guy, Dave, the main character, is a vampire who was created as a vampire by this old world master in order to be the night manager of the master's 24-hour convenience store. Because in our mythology of vampires, like, whoever your master is, you literally have to obey. Like, physically, you have to obey them. So he's being forced to be a wage slave, essentially, by his master. And... The funny thing about this is that these two books have a lot in common in the sense that they both turn out to be about class. And this is like, by looking at Life Sucks compared to La Perdida, and like, how did I go from one to the other, and doing interviews and talking about those two books, it was like, oh, I have a basic theme that I'm writing about, which is class. you know, and then now my new book, my new nonfiction book, which is Trish Trash, Roller Girl of Mars, again, is about class. It's about a class of basically indentured laborers who are stuck on Mars and, you know, are fighting back against the corporation. Why? You know, I was not raised in a socialist household. It's like I've not been, I'm not a red diaper baby. I don't know why this matters to me as much as it does, but clearly it does. Because when I look back through all this different work that I've done, the most passionate stories that I've written, the ones that are like have sustained me for years because they take so long to do, have had that at their core. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. So the thread, I've really wondered about this because it took me a really long time to even arrive at the conclusion of Unmistakable. Probably the better part of 4 or 5 years before we're like, this is the message that we want to share with the world. I'm wondering, you know, what that looks. Do you think it's something that you can only see in retrospect, kind of like that whole Steve Jobs thing with the dots only connecting in reverse? Or do you think that you can figure it out while it's happening?
I think you can guess at it while it's happening.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can really know until you've done a lot. And then it's still happening. I mean, you're making this thing now, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you, it's all done and you're looking back in retrospect. You're still in the middle of it. Mm. But yeah, I think it takes a long time. You know, if you'd asked me at 25 what I would be doing now, I certainly would not have guessed that I'm doing nonfiction about storytelling and fiction about class issues. Like, that's just ridiculous. You know, who plans that? Who thinks that kind of way, you know, ahead of time? Like, you have to find those threads in what appears, you know,
yeah,
what comes out. I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's certain issues that draw us forward, and then, you know, I feel like there, and I'm trying to think if there, I think of a really good example, but I feel like there's times when I've sort of staked out an area and been like, I want to do this. And then I start doing it and I can functionally do it, but it never feels right. And then at some point I figure out, oh, that's because I completely am not interested in this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not an activity I really want to get into. And you have to pay attention to that. Like, you have to feel that in yourself. And when you're doing like the kind of work you do and the kind of work I do, that's highly creative work and very, very demanding. It's not about passion and about like getting up in the morning feeling joyful. You know, that's a dream, but it's not reality. But it is about expressing something central about your relationship with the world. And feeling the satisfaction and some clarity around the thing that you want to talk about. And I think that's why there's a lot of flailing at the beginning of people's creative careers, because they're like trying a bunch of different stuff to see which thing fits.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because you're right. I mean, I would have never figured my exploration of the world and what I want to say about it would manifest in this form.
Right. How could you? I mean, the form didn't even exist.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but yeah, I agree. You know, like, yeah, things like, I feel like my path to, maybe not to what I'm doing, like literally right now with this, with the teaching of systems, but like what I've been doing the last, whatever, 15 years of teaching comics and writing about comics and writing comics and making comics, like it looks like a path laid out with a ruler, you know, like it's such a straight path. And yet I could never have pictured where it was going. And I was on the other side of it, you know, before I got there.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, because, you know, I went out of college thinking very much, you know, sort of straight and linear path mindset. And I've realized how untrue that is. And yet I think the notion that our lives aren't linear and that there's going to be uncertainty causes people a tremendous amount of anxiety. I know, because it's caused me an immense amount of anxiety. I'm just curious, you know, what you have to say about that, given the length of your career and you know, the things that you've done and you know, the people that you've been around.
I think it does cause an immense amount of anxiety. And I think rightfully so, in a sense, because the choices are consequential. I mean, little things that you do, experiments, it's fine, you know, but, you can play around a little bit here and there, but if you start like really investing your time and your energy in something and it turns out something that you just don't want to be doing, or you can't figure out how to make a living at it or whatever, I mean, it's scary, you know? And there's also the functional problem of getting yourself, like figuring out how you're actually going to functionally make your work. Like, how are you going to get yourself to sit down in the morning and get this stuff done? I know you talk about this a ton with all kinds of different people who come on your show. Mm-hmm. It's our obsession. And I think it dovetails directly with this anxiety that we have about where our path is headed. You know, it's all about uncertainty. Like, we don't even know where our path is headed today, you know, much less in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. And that's why people default to day jobs and to careers that are sort of have some kind of linear sense. And that's, I think, why a lot of people feel really a lot of anxiety about work in general right now, is because even day jobs don't have that linearity anymore. You know, we're not prepared for this. Nobody prepares you to figure all this stuff out on your own as you're growing up. I mean, sure, your parents are like, yeah, follow your dreams, do whatever, you know, like maybe some people's parents are anyway, but like, you know, the people in school say, well, what do you really want to do when you grow up? And you can, if you work hard, you can do it, and so on. So there are moments as you're growing up where you're like having to think through what do you think you want to be doing? But it's just, I mean, you know, I want to be a fireman. I want to go to the moon. I want to, you know, all kinds of things come out in that kind of dreaming state. But when it comes down to brass tacks, like, are you going to actually do this? Are you going to invest in your time and your energy in doing this thing? That's a whole other matter, because you don't see the path between here and there. And so not seeing the path means you don't know if it's worth it to you to spend that capital that you have on that effort. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if the more vague the path is to between like me and successful author,
yeah,
the less it likely it is I'm actually going to start out on that path, because I don't know that I can get there. Like, I don't see, it's not clear, you know?
Yeah, well, and the odds are pretty staggering. I remember sitting down with my editor for the first time. I said, how many people get, like, how many of the thousands of blogs and projects online end up here getting to do this? And she said, the numbers are incredibly low. It's like 1 in 5,000 or something ridiculous like that.
Well, that seems high to me.
Okay.
I mean, considering the number of blogs there are in the world.
Yeah, maybe that is. Yeah, who knows? Maybe that is high.
yeah. Well, I mean, but I think you have to go a step further than that, because I'm somebody who's been a published author now, yeah, you know, for major publishing companies for, you know, 10 years. And I can get a book published. You know, if I have an agent, if I have an idea, he'll find a way, you know, whether it's like going to be a good sale or not is another issue, but like, you know, we'll find a way. I also know how to self-publish. You know, I have all these skill sets. Doesn't mean I can figure out how to make that my life, yeah, you know, financially. It's real iffy, you know? So like, a lot of people focus on the get the book published part. To me, that's the smallest part of the problem. Like, then how do you keep going on this and make it work long term?
Yeah. 80% of the people in the world don't fit into a standard size. Chances are you're one of them. Son of a Tailor makes 100% custom fitted t-shirts to the unique measurements of each customer. And ordering is really easy. You simply answer 6 simple questions and their algorithm will construct the perfect t-shirt pattern. No extra measuring needed. And all t-shirts from Son of a Tailor come with a perfect fit guarantee, which means that if you don't love your first t-shirt, they'll make you a new one. No questions asked. And Son of a Tailor has free worldwide shipping. So go to www.sonofatailor.com and use the voucher code creative at checkout for 30% off your first t-shirt. Again, that's www.sonofatailor.com. And use the voucher code creative at checkout for 30% off your first t-shirt. There's an old way to buy a car and a new way to buy a car. Technology continues to evolve,
Everything evolves, really. There was a time when that hard drive you carry on your keychain weighed as much as a ton of bricks and cost about a month's rent, which I know is really hard to imagine if you're a millennial. But there was such a time not too long ago. And before you know it, drones will be delivering all of our packages. So as technology and innovation advances, it would make sense that there's a new and a better way to buy a car. And finally, there is. It's called TrueCar. What makes TrueCar special and unique is their certified dealer network. They've partnered with over 10,000 TrueCar certified dealers that also believe in a new way to buy a car. With TrueCar, you get guaranteed savings, and TrueCar certified dealers will honor the savings. It's that simple. TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off manufacturer's suggested retail price with no hassles or headaches. It's how car buying was always meant to be, and over 2 million cars have been sold by the TrueCar certified dealer network. Visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app and start saving. TrueCar, never overpay. Last but not least, our friends at HostGator. As I told you at the beginning of the episode, just about every job application you will fill out has a field for links or websites. So it's critical that you have one, and our friends at HostGator can help you get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. They have a website builder that's super easy to use if you're not tech savvy, and they have one-click WordPress installs. Having a web presence of some sort isn't an option for your career anymore. It's a necessity. So visit HostGator.com/creative to get started and use a promo code creative for 30% off all hosting packages. Now back to my conversation with Jessica. I would really love to hear about the conceptual story structure that goes into all these things that have become sort of mainstays and sort of mainstream staples of our culture at this point, based on the background and perspective you have. And then, of course, talk about how we can apply some of those to our own work.
You mean the radio shows?
Yeah.
Podcasts?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about radio shows. And I mean, when I talk about radio, I basically am including podcasts because they're very different in how they work. And yet, you know, all the shows that I talked about in the book have podcasts or are podcasts, you know, one or the other. So, and also I think the word podcast is just so dumb. I just can't even, as a cartoonist, and we have always had the dumbest name of a medium, you know, movies, not great, novel, something new. That's not great either. You know, like none of the names are really any good. Comics, it's not funny, not very funny. Podcasts. Oh boy. Okay. Anyway, so when I say radio, I mean podcasts, and let's just take it from there. But so the basic underpinning or the basic kind of radio and podcasting that I talk about is what you call narrative journalism. And the reason it's called that is because it's not just – it's reported, generally speaking. Some of these things are memoirs or whatever. They're not reported. But for the most part, these are reported stories where there are – interviews that go into them, there are facts, there's, you know, stuff like that. But it's then constructed or reconstructed into something resembling a fictional story structure. So when you think about Radiolab or This American Life or 99% Invisible, The Moth, you know, these are shows that are all in the book, they all have their best stories, generally speaking, all have a central character who goes through changes and comes to some kind of has realizations as a result of that. And the reason this is so powerful, this approach is so powerful, is that it is it ties right into our basic need for stories, just plain up, you know, straight up stories, but it also gives the listener an entry point into the ideas, either as a, you know, the character can be kind of stand-in or avatar for the reader, I mean the listener, or you can also, you know, depend on empathy and just depend on our curiosity and empathy, you know, about other people. And so that is the essential feature that makes these stories and these shows as gripping and compelling as they are. Of course, then they have to be good stories and told well, but like at the essential level, it's the difference between most podcasts we listen to, most radio we listen to, is people talking about stuff without any structure. These shows have incredibly thought through, careful structure. So that's number one. And then the book goes through several chapters, and I don't know if you want to like go through them. I mean, do you have questions about specific stuff?
I'd like to go through sort of the step-by-step structure as deep as we can get without giving the entire thing away, if you can do that in the next 30 minutes, which I realize is a big question.
I can try. All right. So the in the book, I laid it out, and this is not necessarily how the producers themselves think about how they build these stories, but I laid it out conceptually sort of in order of the elements that you need to make a great story. So first of all, you have to have a really good idea, right? And so there's always this question that comes up for fiction writers, and I think it comes up for these the producers as well, is like, how do you get your ideas? And basically the answer that I came up with, and we haven't mentioned this yet, but I actually made my own podcast about the book, so getting super meta here. And the first two episodes of that of my podcast are about this idea of like, how do you get ideas? And the way I put it in the podcast is you pay attention to your attention. That's how you do it. You really try to calm the inner critic who tells you you're an idiot when you think about whatever it is that you're interested in. You try to pay attention to the things like the anecdotes you're telling your friends, the things that you're thinking about in idle moments between other stuff. What are the stories or characters or topics or news items or whatever it is that you keep coming back to? And you pay attention to that attention and you go deeper into it. So then you go into research. And this can be for fiction or nonfiction. It's the same thing. You pay attention to what will feed you for long enough as a writer to really dig into it. And that's also how you get stuff that's original. Because even though if it's interesting to you, it's probably interesting to many people. You know, you may hit on a topic that's been covered many times before. You as a unique individual will have your own take on it. And so you have to really, like, getting deep is the way you say something new. If you just kind of skim along the surface, you're not going to say anything new. So from there, so once you have an idea that you feel like you are confident in, that it's something that you've spent some time with, you've done some research on, you have kind of a basic idea of the landscape of this idea, then you start to give it some structure. And this is where different producers really, they go at it different ways. Like I have a couple different structures that several producers have told me about. But for the most part, I think people who are in this position of, you know, if they're producers at Radiolab or something like that, they mostly don't think about it in this like formulaic kind of way. And in fact, most people I talk to, I'd say like, well, what do you think about the focus sentence? And they'd say, oh, that sounds okay, but it's not that simple. Like they just didn't want to let me, you know, I was like, I know it's not that simple, but does it sound kind of right? And they're like, yeah, and it is right. Yeah, but it's not that easy. So the focus sentence, which I got from Rob Rosenthal at the Transom Story Workshop, which is a really excellent training program for narrative journalism producers, is someone does something because, but. And so the idea of the focus sentence is that you fill it in with your protagonist, someone does something. So somebody in motion who has some kind of role in the world, and they're doing that thing because of something. And the because is their motivation. And then the but is what stands in their way. And that's the heart of your story. And then anybody who writes fiction will recognize this as essentially a narrative, the basis of a narrative arc. It's not a full narrative arc, but it's like, you know, get to your inciting incident with that. And for nonfiction, it's the same thing. Like what, you know, an interesting story, you know, you can talk about a, like a gardener, who, works in municipal gardens or something like that. And that might be really interesting. It might be somebody who talks really interestingly, super great character, and you're really interested in this thing. But if you don't have the because and the but, you don't have much, you know? Yeah. Why does he work in the gardens? Well, he works in the gardens because he has to be in fresh air for 12 hours a day or he gets ill. You know what I mean? Like something off the wall and you're on to something, like something a little bit unexpected and you really can get somewhere with it. And then there's another structure that is that I learned from Alex Bloomberg, who's now of Gimlet Media, but when I was doing the book, he was at Planet Money, which is the XY story formula. So the XY story formula is I'm doing a story about X, and what's interesting about it is Y, which is a much simpler approach, but is more useful at this stage when you're dealing with idea-based nonfiction. You know, so if you don't have a central character to your story or you don't have a character yet, you don't know who the character is going to be, the XY story formula is going to be more useful. And what that does is it lets you say, I'm doing a story about a manufacturer of whiteboard pens, you know, whatever. Like it's a topic, it's a thing. And you can totally imagine a news item of 3 minutes, you know, on all things considered, it's like, oh, this manufacturers, you know, things are booming because everybody loves whiteboards, blah, 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 you know, or some kind of whatever. Like, it's a topic. But with the why, what's interesting about it is that's where you get to the reason why you're going to tell this story, right? So you take the topic and you turn it one way or another and you try to figure out what makes this more than just a kind of like commodity news item. You know, this manufacturer is the one who invented wipe-off boards because he couldn't spell, you know, or like, I don't know, he like needed to erase messages because he was a spy in the war. I don't know, you know, I'm making stuff up off the top of my head. But the point being that you have to find that angle on the story that makes it more than just the topic, you know, mm-hmm. And that's where most people stop is with the topic.
Yeah.
And in fact, I apply this all the time when I'm writing blog posts. Mm-hmm. I think about the XY, like most times when I'm writing a blog post, I'm like, okay, I'm writing a blog post about, you know, how to break down your tasks into, you know, little bits. And what's interesting about it is that, breaking it down like this, it seems like it's going to be a huge amount of work, but it makes everything super clear. Like you don't know what you're doing until you start doing that. And then I'm listening to this and myself say this and I'm going, that's not a good why. I need a better why than that. And, you know, you have to rewrite it until you get it right. You know, you get the right thing.
Yeah. So two questions come from that. One of the things I'm always interested in and looking at is how one art form influences the other, especially people who have done, you know, fairly deep work in two multiple art forms. So I'm curious how the comic and storytelling background has influenced your perspective on podcasting and vice versa.
Well, I think the, my doing the comics about radio and podcasting has been very enlightening about what goes into that process. And really has opened my eyes to what that, what it entails and how much thought goes into it. And then when I listen to the stories, you know, I just have a much more educated kind of appreciation for them. And that's been really great. But I've also thought a lot about the ecosystem of podcasting mm-hmm. as a result of working on this book. And it's a part of the book that it kind of didn't make the book. You know, there was like a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to talk about platforms and the difference, you know, between different platforms, but it was so... It didn't fit the kind of overall approach of like storytelling secrets. It was kind of like a sideline. So it kind of just didn't happen, which is too bad because I really do feel like there are significant differences between radio and podcasting, between podcasting and comics, between prose and comics. You know, all the different platforms, they have an influence on the kind of stories they get told. So, you know, for example, in the kind of narrative audio storytelling we're talking about, it excels in conveying emotion, for example, through voices. It does not excel in conveying details. Yeah. Comics are excellent in similar ways at conveying emotion and lots of information through nonverbal storytelling. So, you know, through what's in a scene and people interacting with the scene, people interacting with each other, facial expressions, those kinds of things. Again, comics not excellent at a whole bunch of factual details, and not, you know, you could do it, but it's hard and it's can be tough reading. And same with audio, you know, you can do it, but it can make for real tough audio. And, you know, just thinking about these different platforms and comparing them together, you know, there are many, many differences and many, you know, strengths that, you know, each medium has its own strengths. But what's been cool for me is actually to kind of ignore that and just do it anyway, you know, translate from one to the other, you know. So, like, I've actually taken, you know, audio and prose and converted it into comics in Out on the Wire, and then taken Out on the Wire and converted it back into audio on my podcast. Mm-hmm. And each time new things come out, you know, and it becomes this kind of many-faceted piece of, I don't know, there's just so much, there's so much richness in the different ways you can express something.
Yeah. It's interesting. It kind of reminds me of us taking segments of our interviews and translating them into animated shorts or,
you know,
visual things that we've done, which you would have never guessed in a million years when we started that that's what would come out of them.
Yes. I mean, it's not necessarily like the most, it's not a logical next step, but it does make sense. You know, like in Out on the Wire, you know, there's sequences where I'm drawing audio stories. Like there's a sequence where I actually draw a Radiolab story, and the point of the sequence is to talk about the sound effects.
Yeah.
Okay, that, try to think about that for a second. The point of this 4-page sequence of drawn comics in black and white is to talk about sound effects. So yeah, it's, but I think it's successful. You know, it expresses the sound effects in a really you know, at a gut sort of emotional level, because of the way they're placed in the panel, because of the way the drawing, you know, the drawing changes, and sort of you can kind of, I'm expressing the internal state of the character that he's describing and that Jad described via sound. I'm describing it visually. You know, the best would be to like listen to it and read it at the same time. That would be that. That would be the top. That would really be making it.
So, two final questions for you. One is what you learned about mastery and success from working closely with somebody like Ira Glass.
I think in general, what I've learned about making the kind of work that we make is what I do, what he does is just, it's like this intense focus and, you know, it's grit. It's like you stick with it through the tough times, you know, the work is, it can be backbreaking. I mean, that's whatever. It's not backbreaking. We're not miners. It can be brain breaking. Let's put it that way. And it can be depressing. It can be so difficult. But, you know, you just have to focus and keep going. You know, you just stick with it and keep making it happen. And you have to keep doing that for so long. You know, people think that you can kind of shortcut to this stuff. I mean, I absolutely encourage this. You can make some comics and get them up online, you know, on Tumblr in like a week. You can be a cartoonist. You can make a mini comic in, you know, a month. And I think it's a great thing to do. It's absolutely awesome. But you're not going to be a great cartoonist until you've done that for several years. Maybe a lot of years. Maybe never. You know, but probably you're going to get there if you keep really chipping away at it. But it could take a really long time. And you have to have that self-belief and you have to have that, you know, basically stubbornness, I think, to just get through it. I mean, Ira does this talk all the time where he plays this one clip of himself when he was an NPR reporter, when he was in his early 20s. And he was doing this terrible little news clip. And he makes fun of himself and whatever. And it's part of his whole shtick about the gap. You know, he has this video on YouTube where he talks about the creative gap. And Ira was, you know, even as a very young man, was a, you know, incredibly creative and ambitious person, but he did not have the skill set. He had to build it, and it took years. And he just did it anyway. So, you know, the people who I see who are incredibly successful at making their work, it's because they have focus and they have a kind of stubbornness and a kind of, like, unjustified optimism about where they're going to get with it, you know? Yeah. I mean, initially unjustified. It's like, who knows what's going to happen, but they stick with it anyway. You know, you look at somebody like Stephanie Flew, who is in Out on the Wire and just an amazing radio producer. And I just think she's so awesome. She's at This American Life now, but she used to be at Snap Judgment. And when she was at Snap, she was like, she showed up at Snap as an intern at the age of 20 or something. I mean, she graduated from college, so maybe she was 21, with 20 story ideas, story pitches on the first day as an intern. Within like a week, she was making a story, even though it wasn't part of her job. And within 3 months, she was hired as a producer. And, you know, she did something like on the order of 180 audio stories in the 3 or 4 years she was at Snap. She was a machine. And now she is incredible. And she's only like 27 or something, you know, but she crammed it all in. Like for me, it took more like 15 years to get through that amount of stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't have the amount of energy that she did, but, you see that and you say, oh yeah, that makes sense. I don't want to discourage people who are trying to do this though, because it doesn't take being an incredible Stephanie Fu to get there, but you do have to, build, you know, ways of, getting to work on a daily basis that are built around your creativity, built around the way that you work and the way that you think. And you have to do it and you have to like stick with it.
Yeah. So I have one other question about this that raised actually when you said that the unjustified optimism. You think certain people just have that and that they come out of the gate with that even when they start their work and certain people just don't?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I think probably there are certain people who do have that, and that's a basic advantage. But I don't think that that's a prerequisite.
Yeah.
You know, I think that you know, I'm working with people now in all different areas. I'm working with people who are cartoonists and podcasters and novelists and, you know, all in all these different creative areas, and helping them put together their systems for making their work, actually getting the work done on a regular basis. And it's really interesting to me because people are so different. You know, everybody is so different, and like the things that they struggle with are not necessarily the things I struggle with. You know, I have that stupid optimism where I'm like, yeah, I'll just do it. I'm going to do that thing. And then when I'm like halfway in it, I'm like, oh, geez, that was not a good idea. But there are other people who they let it, many people, you know, they let that stop them. Just stop them cold. And so, you know, they need to build in more fail safes, you know, and you have to have this kind of individual system based on like who you are. Like if you're somebody who needs that kind of external validation, a lot of people are, and there's nothing wrong with that. It just is who you are. And people feel super guilty about it. They feel like that's not okay to have this need for, you know, external deadlines or external validation, because they think it should come from within. Well, I mean, it'd be nice if it came from within. That would be handy. Yeah. But if it doesn't, like, don't waste time beating yourself up about it. Just find a way to get it. you know, set it up somehow so that like somebody's waiting for you to turn something in, or, you know, so somebody's going to be there and say and clap their hands when you get the thing finished, or whatever, you know, whatever it is that you need, you have to build around that.
So I have one last question for you, which is, how we finish all our interviews with the unmistakable creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that question because I've listened to your podcast. And I was like, what am I going to answer that? Because that's a tough one. It's really tough. I feel like, you know, some of the stuff we were just talking about, the idea of, you know, intense focus and, you know, curiosity and openness to the world can make somebody unmistakable, somebody unforgettable, like somebody who's really, really curious and really just like wonders about the world and just wants to get engaged in it is somebody who I would find unmistakable. They're the people I remember. You know, when I think of the word unmistakable, that's kind of what I mean, is like really memorable people that you, who stick with you, you know? Yeah. And that would stick with me. And I think that that, you know, that's reflected in the great report, the great producers that I talked to, and also in, you know, other creative people that I've worked with. You can see it in people. You know, you see that spark in their eyes, and like they start talking about something, and it just is like, it doesn't matter what they're interested in. You know, they're just way in, and you just want to know about it. You want to know more. And there's just this kind of like, I don't know, it's a sense of commitment, I guess, to what they care about, whatever that thing is. I mean, I can listen to people who I just completely disagree with. If they're super into it, it's interesting.
Well, this has been really, really phenomenal. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your stories and your insights with our listeners here at The Unmistakable Creative.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
Now, we've had hard things happen and we've had glorious things happen, and we just try to be fully present every day and not take on a pitiful, self-focused, narcissistic mindset, and work hard at making sure we understand that in every obstacle is an opportunity.
Nancy Duarte joins us to talk about how to ignite change through speeches, stories, ceremonies, and symbols.